We've heard what's happened in the greyhound racing industry in the last 7 days. No doubt the animal welfare organisations are certainly targeting the thoroughbred industry as well. CEO of Racing Australia, Peter McGoran, joins me. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, Sean. Good morning.
Now, we've recently brought in rules that owners have to declare what's happening with their foals and their ownership within a very brief period once the foal is born. I suppose monitoring the life of a racehorse now has never been more important.
Absolutely, Sean. We saw this day coming some years ago. The Racing Australia Board, which represents each of the 8 state and territory principal racing authorities, gave retirement of racehorses absolute priority. So for 2 years, with the operation of new rules where an owner and trainer have to state the destination or the fate of a retired racehorse, we're able to show a good story. And that most horses are lovingly retired to a happy and hopefully long life. Now we must do it for the unnamed thoroughbred, that is, those horses that are not registered until they are racehorses at 2 years of age. We must have that life cycle of traceability so that we can put out the facts, we can combat the worst and wildest assertions and retain the confidence of the community and governments, for that matter.
Peter, we can track the horses who are named and registered. What about those who don't race and perhaps aren't named or deemed not good enough to race? Is there a way of keeping track of those as well?
Yes. All thoroughbred foals will now be registered with Racing Australia. So the 3,000 or thereabouts thoroughbreds who are never registered to race as racehorses, well, we'll know their ultimate destination. There is a requirement under the new rules for the owners to tell us when they've made a decision not to race the horse, where it goes.
What happens if somebody doesn't fill that in honestly?
It's pretty hard to see how they get away with it because we're going to do a lot of auditing. And mm-hmm. In fact, I noticed from former Justice McHugh's report on the greyhounds, he puts a lot of emphasis and a number of his recommendations are based on traceability, and he wants independent audits. Well, I think our stewards are about as independent as you come, but you're quite right. We have to police the adherence to the rules as we do all others.
What's been brought down by High Court Judge Michael McHugh, will the racing industry take much of that on board, what he said about the greyhound industry? Is there much we can basically learn and adopt?
Fortunately, we're well ahead of the curve, and there's no comparison between the two industries. Obviously, we just don't have the wastage issues. It's the wastage issue that's the biggest challenge for greyhounds, because you can police and enforce the ban on live baiting and other dishonest practices, but the wastage issue is a huge problem for the industry going forward. So we're addressing that. We have the full support of governments across the country in the face of a fair bit of criticism. Look, it's human nature, Sean, not to be regulated. No one wants to be regulated. And we're trying to do this with the lightest touch possible. But the fact is there will be forms and there will be accountability so that we can be transparent as an industry.
I suppose the motto going forward for some in the industry who perhaps are fringe dwellers on their attitude, adapt or perish, because the whole industry is going to perish if they don't.
Yes. Look, we have to calmly respond to the animal liberationists. And let's face it, they're about animal rights. They don't even believe in companion animals. So if you go to the 6 leading animal extremist organisations, 5 of the 6... a call for racing to be shut down. That's their ultimate objective. So if they think they can do it incrementally, they will. So we're not naive about this, Sean. but we look to appeal to the wider community, the common sense of Australians. Mm. All they want us to do is do the right thing. But one thing's for sure, the days of just asserting the good practices of your industry are long gone. It's not just animal competition industries. It's basically every industry. You can't just stand up and say, oh, don't worry. We love our animals and they're a bunch of lunatics opposing us. You actually have to put out there the facts, because people want to make up their own mind, and I'm confident we now have the facts.
I saw an interesting post on one of the social media sites today from a, I won't name the trainer, but a good trainer, very good trainer. and detailed the incident of a horse that they gave away as a hack. And I think about 2 weeks later, the horse developed cellulitis and issues. They've spent a fortune trying to get the horse right just to make sure he's safe and he can get around and enjoy just a lovely life. And as he said, there's none of them who criticised there at 3:30 in the morning to help get that horse right. And that's a fair comment to make too.
Oh, absolutely. Most animal liberationists are like greenies. You never see greenies fight bushfires. You never see them out restoring vegetation and the like. It's always farmers or community groups or fire brigades. And so it is with the animal extremists. Not many of them, some do though, have their own horses or care or rehome horses themselves. So, but look, we just have to deal with that hypocrisy or perhaps, to be more generous, inconsistency.
Is the racing industry looking at any more, and for want of a better word, more severe restrictions placed on people? I mean, do you look and say, how far do we go with this?
Look, we've got to bear down these reforms. I notice the animal liberationists are now calling on us. As always, they shift the ground, and they are calling for us to explain what happens to the 3,000 or thereabout brood mares who are retired from breeding when they're, say, barren or too old or too unsuccessful. So that will be their new battleground, and we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But for the moment, we have much of the life cycle of a thoroughbred covered, at least from birth to the retirement of a racehorse.
All right, so at this stage, no more rules or regulations to be put in place. As I said, the registering of foals, while people say, all right, it can be a bit of a pain in the backside, but hey, it's got to be done these days. You just can't ignore these things. They won't go away.
Exactly. So that the foal in the mare return is returned to the stud book, as always, completely the same within 30 days of birth, where it gives the colour, the sex and the date of the birth. It's the 30 days after that that all of the owners have to give their details and agree to be bound by the rules of racing, or the foal won't be accepted into the stud book. And by the way, Sean, you caught me on the hop last week when you said, well, what is the cost associated with the owners filing an owner's declaration form? Well, we've considered that after you raised it, and we've decided not to charge. It'll be quite expensive for us to process all of that, but we'll absorb that cost.
So no cost at all. It's just simply a case of lodge your paperwork, and all's done. So there's no one going to be hitting the hip pocket.
Not from the initial foal declaration form. If there's transfers of ownership later on, that'll be a different thing. But again, we're not looking to make profits out of this. But so thanks for raising that last week. And we had a council of war and decided, we'll cop that one to help the system get up and going and to support the owners.
And it's interesting, Peter, it's not only what the industry does, it's got to be what the industry's seen to be doing as well in the eyes of everyone, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I think this is why what's so frustrating. I was at Randwick on Saturday and quite a few people came up to me and said, don't you kowtow to the loony animals, extremists and so on. Look, I understand that frustration and there is no kowtowing, but you do have to calmly and thoroughly and confidently defend your industry. Look, I've been guilty in the past. In the old days, you used to be able to whack them out of the ballpark by just pointing out to journalists inquiring or the ABC that these people were unreasonable, they could never be satisfied, they're unrepresentative of the larger community. But I'm afraid as the years have gone on and community attitudes have evolved and governments are even more removed from racing of the three codes, then you find that you do have to provide the facts. You can't just brush them off.
No, terrific. Peter, appreciate your time as always, and that's good news. Free now to register your foal. Get it in. It's the old thing. Get it in within 30 days, and it's cost you nothing.
The foal return or the mare return will be the same as always for the stud book. It's the owner now declaring their ownership. Thanks.
That's it. Good on you.
Cheers, Sean.
Peter, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Peter McGoran there, CEO of Racing Australia. It's at 28 past 9 at Sky Sports Radio. Mark Van Gessler, our Chief Steward, joins me. Morning, Mark.
Morning, Sean. How are you?
Good. I suppose just following on from that with Peter, it's something that we've got to do it and be seen to be doing it these days, haven't we?
Most definitely. And it certainly is a step in the right direction to be able to trace from birth to retirement and We applaud Racing Australia in taking those steps.
Just in your experience over the years as a steward, Mark, because people say, oh, there'll be people knock animals around. How many people do you reckon you've seen who weren't kind to horses?
Oh, look, I think you've only got to go to the stables on a daily occurrence, Sean, and see the care that's provided to horses. You know, they're living in some respects in five-star accommodation for horses. You know, you go to the Rosehill or the Ramwick stables and look how their attendants care for them, and you know, they get the best of nutrition, they get the best of care, the best of veterinary services, and look up, you know, there wouldn't be many instances where we've, you know, observed horses being treated in a way that would be concerning.
Well, I had to smile the other day. I spoke to Paul Wheeler, who's one of the biggest greyhound breeders in the country, and I spoke to his wife before him off air on last Friday, and she said, what people don't realise, they lived in a shed for 4 years so the dogs could have the best treatment.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes, you know, the horses take precedence, and you know, that's the attitude that, you know, most people in our industry have, Sean, is that the, you know, the horse comes first, and they get the, you know, the best care possible.
Now, Mark, on another note, the cobalt threshold is something that's always concerned a lot of trainers. There've been a new threshold level for cobalt now.
Yeah, Racing Australia has introduced an amendment to the rules, effective the 1st of September 2016. The current cobalt exemption, or as commonly referred to as a threshold of 200, is now being reduced to 100. And at the same time, Racing Australia has introduced a threshold for plasma or blood of 25 micrograms per litre in plasma. So it'll certainly have some, you know, ramifications with respect to trainers and ensuring that their horses are presented below those new thresholds.
Mark, there are some, I believe, like registered supplements that do have cobalt in them. I mean, people have to be so careful with these now, because various horses' tolerances will vary, won't they?
Look, they will, but I'd have to say, and you're right, that there are, you know, a number of registered products that are commonly used in stables that, you know, will give a small spike in the cobalt level in a horse. And, you know, the studies show that that small spike reduces quite rapidly out of the horse's system. But it will require, you know, trainers to be more mindful when, you know, administering those products, but also, you know, oral supplementation that's sort of contained within feeds and what have you also need to be looked at to make sure that they're not going to present a horse above the threshold. Having said that, that threshold is well above sort of the normal population range of, you know, what horses would be normally. We've done, you know, multiple studies in respect to both urine and plasma levels, and I think the average horse in a stable presents at about somewhere between 5 and 10 micrograms per litre in urine and somewhere just around about 5 in plasma. So, you know, they're still quite generous thresholds that Racing Australia has introduced.
Are we eventually going to get to that point where we're going to have to be so careful with all these things that you, basically it's just going to be plain feed you'll be giving horses?
Look, we don't want to get to that point, and, you know, surely that, you know, these supplements that have been provided to horses, as we just said earlier, are for their, you know, health and well-being, and they offer, you know, some nutritional value to the horses. But, look, I don't think we're going to get to that point. But, you know, as I said earlier, the thresholds that are introduced are still quite generous, and, you know, it's not going to affect the normal sort of supplementation and feeding of horses if trainers adhere to, you know, sort of what the recommended manufacturer's guidelines are in respect to dosage and frequency of dose when they administer these substances. They're not going to be captured by the rules, Sean.
Mark, is there one area they'll have to be careful, and that is if you give a supplement A, B and C and they all contain a product, that you could finish up the combination of three can cause an issue?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's, you know, in our warnings to the industry, we've said that, you know, trainers have to be very careful in respect to, you know, simultaneous multiple supplements. So, for instance, if you've got a number of products that you're using in conjunction with each other, that could give rise to a, you know, an elevated level, and trainers need to be very mindful when, you know, using multiple products that they're not going to, you know, breach the rule.
All right. Well, so now this comes into play September 2016?
That's right, 1 September 2016. So, look, we've been, you know, monitoring cobalt levels in horses for years now, and, you know, we've, in New South Wales in particular, we're very proactive in respect to, you know, providing trainers with warnings relative to horses that are, you know, starting to creep up, and, you know, we intend to continue that program of education to try and ensure that, you know, we don't get any changes in the near future falling foul of the rule.
All right, terrific. Appreciate your time as always, Mark, and explain it for everyone so they know that's the situation as of the 1st of September.
Yep, good. Thanks, Sean.
Good on you. Thanks a lot, Mark. Mark Van Gestel, our Chief Steward, joining us there. Peter Snowden, I tell you what, I looked at the number of trialers Peter's got. He's a busy man at the moment with horses going everywhere, but he's allowed us a few minutes this morning, and I appreciate that. Morning, Peter.
Morning, Sean.
I tell you what, I've just had a look here. You've got trialers going everywhere at the moment. It's that time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's that time of year, and it's a good time of the year to be busy. Hopefully we've got some bit of firepower going into the carnival.
Now, first of all, we obviously got to ask the capitalist, down to trial at Randwick on Friday?
Yeah, no, he'll trial there.
All right, and how's he going at this stage?
Yeah, really happy with him. He's ticking over nicely. We sort of, as you know, we turned him out straight after slipper, so he came in a bit earlier and hit him out of the cold and had a really nice grounding. And I know he's good to really had to feel like two trials and haven't really locked the first start in, but possibly it's been mentioned that we're running the missile first up.
Mm-hmm. I saw where the Coolmore perhaps was his grand final. Is that it?
Yeah, well, it's probably the ultimate race. All 3-year-old colts are likely to head. Being what it is, it's a great race to win if you're good enough. And that'll certainly be on the radar. Honestly, his form warrants it, and he's come back as he left last prep.
Now, has he always surprised you a little bit, Peter, this bloke along the way he's just kept, you raised the bar and he just keeps getting to it?
It never surprised me, but I was just pleasantly pleased the way he kept progressing, and that's what good horses do. There's plenty of horses show what he did early, but only a very small minority keep on doing what he did. That's the sign of, as I said, of a good horse. The ones just keep on improving from one run to the next, and physically they're there because they're precocious 2-year-olds. But you just that ability you see in races, that extra bit they keep finding, it's very rare, but when you get one that does, they're normally going to be good horses.
I found it fascinating. On your website, you described Octagonal, Lonro and Denman as babies and the way they progressed. And it was interesting, the word soft was used a couple of times in the description, I think, of Octagonal and Lonro. And, I mean, not soft in attitude, but, I mean, obviously you just had to take a little bit of time.
Yeah, like that just shows, as I just mentioned earlier, greatness is in 2-year-olds. It's very rare. And those two in particular, especially Octagonal, he was a very light horse. He was very immature. What he did at 2 was just stated what sort of ability he had. He was just a very, very talented horse, and the older he got, the more he furnished and the better he got. But to do what he did at 2 on his first race start was pre-Christmas in December, and he won easily, and he second start was the top of the 3rd in a Golden Slipper. So that's a tough ask for an immature 2-year-old, but he stood up and you can make a case he's very unlucky not to win the slipper. He did win the Todman and got beat at next in the slipper. So it's just those special horses just do special things.
Lonro, he knocked up 11 Group 1s for you, and your description was almost identical to his dad, soft early.
Yeah, well, actually, you didn't do it for me. You did it for John Hawks. And he looked after him really well, but I was part of that ride with Paul, used to ride and work as well, so we all had a hanging on his tail there. But he, too, was a great horse. Just kept on improving. He too was soft, immature, went shin through a couple of times. He still raced to a high level. And as he got older, and given that time to mature, we'd never hammered him at all. He just got better and better.
I found fascinating your knowledge of horses, but you said at Darley you had to learn the history of their mares, about 300 of them by the time they were whittled down and combined with Ian Bloodstock. And basically you learnt the traits of the families.
Yeah, that's probably the best part of being in a position where the same sort of stock comes through. You get very familiar with the families and the way the pedigree, whether they're early runners or need time or whether they tie up leaders. There's thousands of little things you sort of take on board when you know the families well, and it's very, very helpful, and especially knowing when to bring them in, how early to put them under pressure, and even though they're different, they're normally a pretty good guide as to how the offspring will be from what the previous ones have done before them. It's not always, but it's a general rule that they're close to the mark.
Now, Peter, it's interesting because the Darley and Ingham organisations basically are breeders. They don't tend to buy, do they?
No, we hardly bought it all whilst the time it was Crown Lodge. Not in my time. We did buy early in the piece when Don was there. But we found that we were sort of breeding as good a horse as we're buying. And that was the case with Lonro. So It's very, very expensive, as you know, at the sales. You're buying those top-priced horses if they don't produce. So we were lucky enough to have good mares and the right sort of stallions to be breeding our own horses, and we're very successful in doing that.
Now, with your knowledge with all that, I've got to ask this question. Did you find that they tended to throw more to the dam side? If you had a mare who threw a couple of good ones, she tended to consistently throw good ones, or did it really depend on the sire?
Oh, look, for me, I'd go on the female side. I think a good mare will throw a good horse to any stallion. But a stallion doesn't always throw a good horse to any mare. So I think for me, it's probably 80% mare. The stallion does complement if it's the right sort of stallion, the right cross. But it's, I think you've got a good, really good brood mare. She'll throw a good horse to anything. Par Four is one that comes to mind. Like, she went to about five different stallions and through Group 1 winners to everything she went to. So they're the sort of mares that are very special, and to get a hold of one of those, you know, you can't go wrong.
Now, Peter, I noticed you get a lot of babies, two-year-olds, and these will be a lot of, I suppose, the latecomers who perhaps are a little bit immature. You're trialling them now, and quite a few of them have had a couple of trials, tipped out their back. Have you got anything there that you look and think, gee whiz, if this had raced as a two-year-old, it might have been close to Capitalist?
Yeah, well, we've seen one the other day, Mediterranean.
Yeah.
He fit that category. And
he's related to Capitalist, isn't he?
He is too. He's the same sister of Capitalist's mother, yeah. Strong family, but he was one we sort of always knew that it would come a bit later. And Taj Mahal's another one that comes to mind. So we've got a few there that have been lightly raced, but certainly, and now they've really developed, they look, come back in fantastic order. And really looking forward to the spring with them to see how far they can go.
How's the wet affected you with all the, you know, like Capitalist and DEFCON and these sort of horses and so forth? Has it restricted you with working them?
It's been very difficult, Sean, but I said earlier about the bit I've been in work doing something and being out in the cold and just freezing cold, damp, wet ground and not exercising. I think you've been in a stable environment, at least they're getting rugged and fed properly and doing some exercise, the sort of things are ticking over. So that's the idea of bringing him in a little bit earlier, just the bit of bringing him and being in the paddock. But it's been difficult, as for everyone this time of year. It's only a couple of months you've got to put up with it for, but it is very, very trying when you're getting torrential rain for about 5 days in a row and the tracks are a bog. It's a nightmare. But anyway, we're all going to go through it and tough it out, and don't always come good the next day.
Now, Pete, is there one there that hasn't raced yet that we can have as a little one just between ourselves? I mean, we won't share it. It'll be all right.
It's pretty well exposed. Most of mine, as I said, I've trialled them before, even though I didn't race them at a trial, so they're all fully exposed to what they can do. But I'm confident we've got some nice horses going in the spring, and as I mentioned, two there, I think hopefully there's a few others that can come back. DEFCON is back in the stable. He's done a good job. The two-year-old is really furnished now. He looks in great order, so fingers crossed with some nice horses. Nice young horses going forward in the spring carnival.
And just let James Harrod loose at the sales. That's what you want to do, isn't it? He's got a good eye.
He has got a good eye. And Henry Field, he's also with China Horse Club with Michael Wallace. They've done really well as well. I think they've got a lot of young horses coming through. When we've seen one recently, a horse called Russian Revolution. He's a really nice horse as well. And another one, the Ray Shorty horse called Calander. They're really nice horses, and they've got futures. And James bought very well, and I'll be lucky to be associated with that. But Henry and Michael have bought just as well with China Horse Club, and I'm sure they're going to have a lot of success shortly as well.
Peter, just finally, I did note one thing on your website too, and it was the benefits of taking the horses to the beach and the cold water. As compared to the old theory years ago, alternate hot and cold, but now it just seems the cold is the best, isn't it?
Yeah, well, cold is definitely the best. We ice a lot of horses. Probably 80% of our horses get iced after fast work, and probably 75% get iced every day. It's just, you can't beat it. You see your athletes now, and as soon as they finish games, they're put into ice baths, and they got their ankles and shoulders and whatever in ice straight away. So it's definitely the best thing for recovery. It's scientifically proven that it does work. For me, I'd want a taser on me to get me on those ice baths. But even the beach is freezing cold. We don't go as much in the winter. No, I've stopped going there now. It's just too cold and windy. But it's definitely in the spring and summer months, it's outstanding. It's just, the horses love it. You know, they start singing out in the float. They smell that salt air. They really know what's coming up, and they thoroughly enjoy it. But answer to your question, that ice is cold water. It's very, very good.
So we'll see in the form guide, if you're going to the beach, P. Snowden in brackets, spectator.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm man the beaches. I'm the watcher. I'm the spotter.
All right. Peter, thanks for your time this morning. Great to catch up, and we look forward to seeing Capitalist Trial on Friday.
My pleasure, Sean. Well, you're welcome.
Thanks, Peter. Peter Snowden joining us there at 17 to 10 at Sky Sports Radio. We look forward to Border Muscle, Terra Vista back in action. Wine and Dines, another. Joe Pride's always got a good horse in the camp. And he's joining us now. Morning, Joe. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Sean. Good.
Good. We've got to check on a few of our mates here. Border Muscle and Terra Vista is still aiming at the spring, the Moyer.
Yeah, Border Muscle will go towards the Moyer. He came back in his second week of training now, but... He'll be aimed up at that first up. Race he ran really well in last year, and Terra Vista's not until early part of August, another few weeks ago.
All right, now Wine and Dine's another nice horse you got in the camp at the moment too.
Oh, he's an old trooper. He's going through this winter period, and he's been racing really well, which is nice. It could be his last preparation, but I probably said that last time with him as well. So. We'll see how he finishes off, but he's been a good provider for the stable.
You've had a terrific run with the progeny of Par 4. Is there any more on the horizon there, Joe, that we haven't sighted yet?
No, not for me. Peter Snowden's got a Zabil Par 4 who's raced a few times, and after that, I'm not sure. I think she's nearly finished, so I'm pretty sure I'm hoping we've got the three best ones in our stable anyway, but yeah, she'd be fantastic for us.
Well, as Peter just mentioned her a moment ago, and said she'd throw a good horse to the lead pony almost, wouldn't she?
Yeah, she's amazing mare, and those mares sort of you only see them once every now and again, and feel very privileged to have trained some of her progeny.
Ball of Muscle, the Moyer first up, or would he have a run before that?
No, that'll be first up. He'll be tuned up for it though, because he generally takes a run or two to get to his peak, so we're going to have him nice and ready for a first up run.
A couple of trials under his belt or not?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, to get him right. And Terra Vista, what's the main target for Terra Vista?
Look, he hasn't got a spring target.
Yeah.
He's got an autumn target, and that being, being first up in the Lightning, a race he should have won last year. So we're aiming at that. Whether or not he races in spring is yet to be decided. I just want to see when he comes back in how he's coping, and if we get a run into him, even if we get a trial or two. I didn't want to leave him out for that entire time because he's such a big horse. Get a little bit gross, and I didn't want him putting on that much weight and losing some of his athleticism, so he'll have a very light prep.
All right, and Joe, finally the soccer. You're a soccer coach. You've had success recently too, and big win.
Yeah, we actually won a game 6-0, which is good. It's our only win, but...
I didn't say that. No. I just highlighted the win.
Because it's a nice thing, last start winners. We had to play again last week, so... Unfortunately, you got down there, but now it's good fun, and the kids have a ball. They're a joy to train. 10-year-old kids, they're really fun.
I reckon I know who might be having the most fun.
Yeah, probably right. We managed to train once a week, which is good. And these cold kids, don't do you any favours when you're out on the field, I can tell you.
The form coming will read, Joe Pride, BK, big kid.
Yeah, that's probably about right, I think, yeah.
Good on you, Joe. Good luck with that Terra Vista and Baller Muscle, and good luck with the kids coaching them at soccer too.
Great, good on you. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Joe. Joe Pride joining us there. Gordon York produced an apprentice the other day. First up, he got the money, Eric Chung, and I thought we'd find out a bit on his background. Morning, Gordon.
How are you, champion?
I'm good, mate. Now, I looked the other day and I thought, hang on a minute, Yorkie's put this young boy on four horses. And I looked 4 kilos. I couldn't find he'd ridden in a race. And I thought, normally you'd put a kid on first day, one or two. And you whacked him on all four. And then we soon found out why. He got the money on the first one, his first ride in a race. And I thought, the shifty fisherman.
Yeah.
Where did you find him, Yorkie?
Mate, Eric came to me a while ago. He was doing work in Hong Kong, and he's a bit tall. So anyway, he came to Australia at the recommendation of a guy called Mark Sims, who was one of the teachers at Train Tech in Queensland. And he said, look, if you're a chance in Australia, go and see Gordon York. He'll have all the Japanese and he'll show you how to get a license. So anyway, long story short, he stayed with me. He's worked hard, pushed. We've done all the visa work. We've done all the, jumped through all the hoops through Racing New South Wales and everything, and finally got him licensed. And as you can see, the reason why I put the effort in, because the guy is Malcolm Johnson in the making. And to prove it, he got suspended on his first winning ride as well.
Yeah, he wrote it out. He was enthusiastic. Is probably the best way to put it.
To say the least. 10 years ago, they would have clapped him all the way, but nowadays he was enthusiastic.
He copped a week and 500 up his winning ride first up.
Yeah, and that'll stay with him for the rest of his life. But now, yes, he was very excited. But most kids can't pull the stick. So, Sean, you can see why we've come this far. Not only can pull it, he can pull it through, switch sides, you know, keep it straight, ride him out hands and heels. He's the real deal. And it's just his dream. He's not from a racing family. He's not a Hong Kong jockey club apprentice. He's over here on his own. He's done the hard yards on his own, and he's now in the Gordon York School of Hard Knocks.
Where did he learn? Because the way he sat on, you looked at him and thought, if you'd said this guy's ridden in 1,500 races, you'd go, yep, not a problem. First up, he sat down and he rode the horse out well. Where's his background from?
He rode a bit of track work over there. He did go into the apprentice school in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they take 100 every year, and out of that, about 4 get through.
Whew.
Right, and him being a bit taller, he was on the short list anyway. And, they produce a lot of their own work riders as well, and they're very highly paid over there to ride track work. So it's a career in itself, being a work rider. But Eric's a natural lightweight, and his dream was to be a jockey. So he ventured over here at the advice of Mark Sims to obtain an Australian apprenticeship and become a jockey, because then the world's their oyster. You know, they can...
Yeah.
A lot of the Japanese boys I had ended up in Singapore and Macau and places like that. They sort of can find a home.
Well, he not only won that day at Costa, he came out of Taree and won well there as well. He's ridden 2 winners from about 6 rides.
Yes, yes, and 4 placings. So, you know, he rides them good, don't worry about that, and he won't have a claim for long, but... As a racehorse, you've got to market him and put him in the right races. So what I'm doing is focusing on getting his country claim away.
Mm.
And hopefully this season we can do that, which, you know, we should, barring things going wrong. But I'd like to see him win the country premiership as his first year and then move to the provincials. And then you know what's going to happen. Mm. They'll snap him up in town and that'll be the end of it. So,
well, you put a fair rap on him and you said a Malcolm Johnson in the making.
Yes, yes, Malcolm. I asked Malcolm at the very beginning when he was trialling, I said, Malcolm, I want you to watch this kid because he goes very good. I said, and he's got no fear in him whatsoever. He sums up a race. We talk about different things. He didn't have a lot of English when he started with me. So when I say a word he doesn't understand, we talk it out. So he's very keen to know everything about everything. And even in his first ride, John, as you've seen, it was 1,000 metres. He come from last.
Yeah.
He didn't lead all the way. He come from last, and he didn't go round them. He went through them.
The most important thing, can he bait a hook and gut one for you?
He doesn't need to. Like, if he just keeps riding winners, we'll be able to just sit out on charters and someone else will do it for us.
Hey, good on you, Yorkie. Good to catch up. And good luck to him, too, because he can sit on. He really can. And he's going to go through the Gordon School of Gordon York School of Hard Knocks, I think.
Yeah, mate. We should have been winning today, but they've made a balls up in Rise and scratched me horse.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, both races. So
You would have been gracious about that too, I reckon.
Oh, mate, he's sitting there kicking the bloody floor like 50 kilos on a good thing at Wyong today.
Never mind.
He's got his bottom lip on the ground. He said, if this happened in Hong Kong, somebody'd lose their job.
Well, if he got that out, his English has improved.
Oh, yeah, expletives with it as well, but all that right. Was pretty much the main deal.
All right, good on you, Gordon. Good to catch up. Good luck, mate.
Two champion, we'll catch up at the carnivals, eh?
All right, no worries. See ya.
See ya, buddy.
Michael Friedman has settled in well now here in New South Wales, back from Singapore after 8 years and a great run there, and he's with us now. Morning, Michael, how are you?
Good, Sean, how are you?
Good. I do love the story behind Henry the Creator. Now, he's a smart horse. He's had 2 starts for you, 2 wins, I think, a good 4 and a heavy 10, so he can handle all going.
Yeah, look, he's been a bit of a find, you know. He was only a cheap yearling at the Magic Million sales in June last year, and I've been really happy with how he's come up. He's actually surprised me a little bit.
Now, the story behind him is lovely, and how the ownership group got together. Tell us that, Michael.
Yeah, well, the guys there from the UK, and they sent a horse to me when I was in Singapore to train, and we had a little bit of success with him, and unfortunately he died from a bad bout of colic. And at about the same time, I'd just been to the sales at the Gold Coast, and Henry the Creator was a spec buy, so I just mentioned to them that, you know, whether they'd be interested in taking him up now that the other horse sadly passed away, and they jumped at the opportunity. So this is the first horse that they've ever raced in Australia, so, you know, to say the least, they've had a great start.
The dam side on him's a good, strong New Zealand dam line, going back to that very good mare, Ambassadora.
Yeah, look, and as I said before, he's probably surprised me a little bit. You know, he sort of started with Lee Anthony in Melbourne, just basically with the intention initially of getting ready to go to Singapore. But obviously, once I decided to move back, the guys were happy for him to stay here and race here. And I think he's definitely, you know, taken some fairly big steps, because I think initially the opinion was that he might have only been an average customer. But, you know, whilst he hasn't set the world on fire just yet with the two wins, but, you know, I think he might be heading in the right direction.
It must have been a big culture shock, and just a shock in training experiences going to Singapore, the heat, the humidity, the whole lot.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, are quite similar there, you know, training-wise, but there's also a lot of things that are very different. And it was a real challenge, which was one of the main reasons why I went there in the first place. I found it a great experience. You know, I think, you know, it was really, it was something I needed to do at the time. And, you know, I really enjoyed the 8 years that I had there.
You had a terrific run, over 400 winners. You had, I think, 12 Group 1 winners, and not only in Singapore, but I think did you get one in Japan or somewhere as well?
No, I did a bit of travelling with horses. Probably the best result was I got beaten narrowly in Dubai 1 year in the Al Quaz with a horse called Better Be The One. He went down by, I think it was a short half head, from memory, to JJ the Jet Plane. So that was probably the best result I had internationally. But it was a great experience the whole 8 years. And you know, whilst I was very much ready to come back, you know, late last year, I thoroughly enjoyed the time I had there.
Would have been a good learning curve, I reckon, Michael, the travelling experiences, going from country to country, different climates, the whole lot.
Oh, very much so. You know, and I think, you know, if you ask any trainer, you know, one of their ambitions would be to sort of get the opportunity to take a horse overseas and campaign against, you know, other horses from different countries. But, you know, I was lucky enough to have a horse that was, you know, good enough to do that. And, you know, whilst we didn't come away with a win, it certainly was a great experience.
Was the decision to come back to Sydney basically based around family and your children?
Yeah, it was. You know, I felt that after 8 years there, I'd sort of got to the stage where I was perhaps getting a little bit stale. And that, coupled with the fact that, you know, my kids at the age of 14, you know, were starting to get deeper into their senior school years. And, you know, Anna and myself sort of had a good chat about it and felt that, you know, it was either sending them back to board and remaining in Singapore or coming back as a family, and obviously we chose the latter.
It seems like you love challenges, because you went to Singapore, then you came back and thought, I won't go to the comfort zone of Melbourne, I'll go to Sydney.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that is definitely, you know, a big part of my makeup. I do enjoy a challenge, and, you know, probably would have been somewhat easier to go back to familiar territory like Melbourne. But that also, you know, posed some potential, you know, issues with the fact that I was keen to continue doing my own thing and running my own business, and I wasn't that comfortable with the idea of doing that in the same city as my brothers, and they probably felt a little bit the same way. So that certainly was a part of the decision to come to Sydney. But also, you know, I was born in Sydney and was sort of really keen on the idea of coming back to Sydney and trying living there and carving my new business in a city like that. So, you know, it's been a sort of a tough year, in the sense that it's taken a while to sort of get set up and get staff and all that. But you know, I've been wrapped with the level of support that I've been given by, you know, many different owners and breeders, and you know, it sort of sets us up pretty well now to sort of get stuck into the new season.
Did many of the overseas owners come with you, or was it basically almost start from scratch again?
Pretty much starting from scratch. I had a couple of Singaporean owners who have got horses with me, but by and large, you know, the Singaporean owner gets it pretty good up there, and I think the idea of sort of telling them that it was, you know, race a horse back in Australia for potentially less prize money at an increased cost of training was probably a hard one to sell. So, yeah, I've got a couple of, that have remained with me, which is good, but the rest is, it's been basically starting from scratch again.
All right, well, it's good to see Henry get the flag up the pole for a start for you, which is good. Yeah. It's nice to get that one on the board, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's no better way to promote your business than to get a winner or two. So, you know, I was mindful of wanting to sort of try and get off to a good start. And, you know, I think we've only had 10 or 11 runners in total. So to get a horse like Henry the Creator to step out and win two from two and have my first City runner win was certainly a great boost.
Well, Michael, we appreciate your time this morning. Good luck. Let's hope the spring brings a few nice winners for you.
Great. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Michael. Michael Friedman joining us there. That's Racing HQ. I'll join you tomorrow morning from Grafton. It is Sky Sports Radio.